This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. A surprising report today from the Census Bureau. The number of Americans without health insurance is down. But there's a catch. While more people have coverage this year, many analysts say that won't last. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
It's always good news to see a decline in the number of uninsured. The federal government reports that in 2007, 1.3 million more people had health insurance than in the previous year. Karen Davis is president of the research group, the Commonwealth Fund.
All of that decline can be attributed to improvement in government health insurance programs, which constitutes the nation's safety net insurance system.
Programs like Medicaid and state insurance plans for low-income children. In fact, the biggest jump was among children. About 600,000 more children now have health insurance. But in the private sector, the news isn't as good. The trend among small businesses to drop or curtail health benefits to employees, says Davis, continues.
Employers just are finding the premiums harder and harder to afford. They don't get the same premiums as do large employers, and workers are finding it harder and harder to pick up their share of the premium. The paychecks just don't stretch to cover the premiums.
What these numbers show today is that the uninsured are not going to decrease magically, even if there's been a slight decline in 2007.
Diane Rowland is an expert on the uninsured with the Kaiser Family Foundation. Rowland says it remains a dire situation when 45.7 million Americans still have no health insurance and millions more are underinsured.
And so this is going to be a big issue. It's not going away. State efforts can help to decrease this when the economic times are good, but states get in economic straits when the economy turns downward. That means federal action is most likely going to have to be there if we're ever going to address the substantial uninsured.
Both presidential candidates have described the current health care system as costly and needing reform. John McCain and Barack Obama both suggest subsidies and tax credits to help individuals buy insurance. Obama would require all parents to cover children under 18, and he'd expand public programs to make sure children of lower-income families have coverage. And the highlight of McCain's proposal is a $5,000 tax credit for families. The big question, says Rowland, will any of it really help, especially when the cost of a typical comprehensive insurance plan for a family of four is $13,000 a year and growing.
In any reform proposal, one of the debates is going to be, at what level of income do you provide assistance to people? When are people well off enough, quote, to be able to afford their own coverage without any assistance from the federal government?
The major squeeze, of course, the bigger the help, the bigger the cost. And the money to pay for expanded health coverage has to come from somewhere, either from employers, including small businesses, or from individuals. Obama would require employers to either provide benefits or contribute to a fund that would provide coverage. McCain makes no such rules for employers or individuals. And neither candidate is particularly deep on details. Probably a good political decision, says Rowland.
I think if history provides any lessons, it's that the more detailed a candidate gets before elected, the more strings are tied around them when they try to act after elected.
One of the lessons of the Clinton health reform battles of the early 90s, says Rowland, don't be too specific too soon. Everybody will start battling it out and nothing may ever get done. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
A dismal report today on the state of U.S. banks. The industry turned in meager profits of $5 billion in the second quarter. That's a decline of more than 80% from this time last year. This gloomy assessment came from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation this afternoon. The FDIC said U.S. banks are having to set aside more and more money to cover their losses from bad real estate loans. For more on this, NPR's Jim Zaroli joins us from New York. And Jim, as part of this FDIC report, I understand there's a list of problem banks. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, every 3 months, the FDIC puts out a report about the health of the banking sector. And normally it doesn't get a lot of attention, but these are not ordinary times in the banking business, so these reports are getting a bit more scrutiny. And what the FDIC does is it tries to quantify how many banks are at risk of failing. That doesn't mean they will fail, of course. It just means they're kind of on the edge. It does not name them because that would make the customers of the banks pretty nervous, and you'd have, you know, old-fashioned run on the bank in a lot of places. But the FDIC does give numbers, and what the report today said was that 117 banks were at risk of failing at the beginning of July. That's compared to 90 at the end of March. If you want to measure it another way, the total assets at these problem banks went from $26 billion to $78 billion. Now, much of that was because of the failure of one very big bank, IndyMac, which is the big California mortgage bank that was taken over by the feds in July.
Now, we mentioned that the FDIC is talking about bad real estate loans that these banks are having to cover. What other problems are the banks dealing with?
Well, the problem kind of goes beyond real estate loans. You have a lot of banks that are seeing mortgage losses right now, of course. And as they lose money, they're having to put more and more money into reserves to cover bad loans. The FDIC has actually been pressuring them to do this. When they have to set money aside, it's reflected in their bottom line. So the $5 billion that the industry made last quarter, that was its second worst performance since 1991. It's just a scary time for the banks. The chairman of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, held a press conference today, and she made pretty clear, you know, things are going to get worse before they get better.
A scary time. And how big a problem is this from the federal government's perspective?
Well, Sheila Bair was asked about that. What she said is that the vast majority of banks in the United States are still well capitalized. That's not a problem. We've seen a rise in the number of people who cannot pay their loans. It's still a manageable number. The problem is this. The FDIC, as you probably know, insures the money that people have in their banks up to $100,000. It has a fund it uses to pay depositors when their bank has problems. The money for this fund comes from the banks themselves, the banks that the FDIC regulates. It charges them premiums. The more banks fail, the more strained the FDIC fund becomes. The IndyMac takeover in particular used up a lot of FDIC resources. And when that happens, the FDIC has to raise premiums. It charges banks, and it's doing that right now. There have been significant increases in bank premiums.
And when the FDIC does that, when it raises premiums, what effect does that have on the banks?
Well, it aggravates the troubles they're experiencing. And the troubles at the banks are a big reason why the economy is slowing so much right now. The banks have had all these losses in real estate and subprime, and they've become afraid to lend money. Even though the Federal Reserve has lowered short-term interest rates a lot, they just haven't been lending. So when they have to pay higher premiums, when they have to set aside more money in loan reserves, it just hurts their bottom line. It makes them more scared, and that postpones the rebound in the economy a little bit more.
Okay, NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York. Jim, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Walmart created a stir a couple of years ago when it announced it was moving into the organic food market. Now the nation's top grocery seller is promoting its locally grown produce. The company touts the community benefits, but it's also a way for Walmart to cut down on fuel costs. Reporter Jenny O'Mara from member station KXJZ in Sacramento has more.
Some things you can expect to see at any Walmart you go to.
Okay, thank you for shopping, Walmart. You have a nice day.
But at this West Sacramento Supercenter, there's something different. The produce area is covered with bright green and white signs, highlighting products that are California grown. Walmart says partnerships with local farmers have grown 50% over the past 2 years, and not just in California, but in Walmart stores across the country. This year, it plans to buy about $400 million of locally grown produce. Walmart spokeswoman Tiffany Moffitt says the primary benefit to the company is savings on fuel costs to the tune of millions of dollars a year. Local partnerships have become the company's latest PR mantra.
It's estimated that in the United States, produce travels an average of 1,500 miles from farms to homes of consumers. So it just provides us an opportunity to make products closer to home and buy local.
But the retailer's definition of what constitutes locally grown doesn't match the one promoted by many in the so-called local food movement. You'll find many of them at local farmers markets.
This is a scene usually associated with that local food movement, organic produce, small farmers, some who truck their products just a dozen or so miles down the road. That's not exactly what Walmart is talking about.
This is a weekly Saturday morning farmers market in Sacramento. Farmer Patrick Hoover is ladling blueberries into small plastic boxes and offering samples. He's driven less than 50 miles from his 40 acres up in the foothills to sell them. And that's what most locavores, the fans of locally grown food, say is real local food. Walmart says, on the other hand, anything grown in the same state is local food. Hoover says selling to Walmart doesn't really appeal to him.
The quality I have, I don't do any markets like that just because my stuff is picked ripe and the only shelf I want it on is between here and the customer at home. And sitting in any retail store is just not good for my produce.
But farmers who sell at such markets acknowledge their products are usually more expensive than what you find in the stores, due in part to the additional labor involved. Many of Walmart's local producers are large-scale farmers that can supply in bulk. Saving on fuel costs is one of the benefits to Walmart of this new locally grown strategy, and it certainly benefits local farmers. But Professor Dan Sumner says if the company's strategy catches on nationwide, it could spell problems for a major growing state like California, where much is shipped elsewhere. Sumner teaches agricultural economics at UC Davis.
If people decide they're going to consume locally, that means they're probably not consuming our walnuts and apricots and almonds and everything else we grow around here.
Still, locally grown might not be that big a selling point for Walmart customers. Back in the produce aisle at the West Sacramento Walmart, the locally grown theme isn't having much impact on Thomas Teeny, who says for him, it's all about the household bottom line.
We're kind of on a tight budget right now, the whole economy. It's not really that great of importance to us. We just buy what's cheap.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny O'Mara in Sacramento.
The drop in oil and gas prices is a relief to many Americans, like people we've been interviewing in recent days in the far suburbs, people with long commutes. It's almost the first thing they mention. The continuing drop in housing prices may not be such good news for everybody, unless you're a home buyer who can finally afford to get into the market. In California, among other places, home prices have fallen so much that many people are now buying houses that have been out of reach for years. Though for first-time buyers, the path to home ownership can still be rocky. From member station KXJZ in Sacramento, Steve Milne reports.
Debbie Payne is in her new backyard, shoveling a pile of fist-sized gray and white rocks.
These little rocks weigh a whole lot more than I thought.
Payne is scooping the rocks into a planter near her swimming pool. Do-it-yourself projects like this are one of the pleasures of home ownership.
This, to me, is just like paradise. We pretty much live in the backyard.
Payne and her partner, both approaching 50, are nurses. They bought this two-story house in Sacramento's modest Rosemont neighborhood last month for $275,000. A year ago, it would have sold for $100,000 more. The 30-year-old home has four bedrooms and two and a half bathrooms. Sitting at her dining room table, Payne remembers when she and her partner got the call from the realtor that after three long years of house hunting, this house was finally theirs.
Oh my gosh. We were screaming up and down. Just couldn't even believe it.
But now, after 6 weeks in the house, this is what they can believe in: home repair.
It was pretty much a mess.
This house had been foreclosed upon and was left vacant for 6 months.
We've had some major repairs to do, some plumbing problems, and we've got holes that are in the floor that we have now discovered. So we've got some work ahead of us.
And that's pretty typical for people buying a foreclosed home. Knowing how to swing a hammer will definitely come in handy, according to Kathy Fox, a real estate agent in Sacramento.
In many cases, the bank-owned homes need some fixing, and more fixing than a neophyte is prepared or understands that they can do. And some of the best buys are in areas that maybe are not the favored areas in terms of the neighborhoods that people want to live in.
They may not be dream homes, but bargain hunters are snapping them up. The real estate research firm DataQuick reports that sales in the Sacramento area are up more than 70% from the same time last year. DataQuick's Andrew LePage says it's the same story across California as buyers embrace falling prices.
We see that from the northern stretches of the state all the way down to the border with Mexico in inland areas where we've seen a lot of depreciation. These are the areas that are seeing sometimes a doubling or more in sales relative to a year ago.
In fact, a year ago, only 24% of Californians could afford to buy a home, according to the California Association of Realtors. Now, it's 48%.
And then this is the master bedroom, which...
bringing more proud homeowners like Debbie Payne into the housing market. For NPR News, I'm Steve Milne in Sacramento.